The following podcast was created to help 100 Women in Finance members learn more about us, our programs and priorities, and especially our people. In this series, we introduce you to our Global Association board members, the people who steer the organization through sound governance and financial management and ensure that we advance our mission. We hope that you enjoy the podcast, and we welcome your feedback at media@100women.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Amanda Pullinger, CEO of 100 Women in Finance. In this episode of our Meet the Board Member podcast series, I'm delighted to introduce our members to Judy Posnikoff. Judy has served on the 100 Women in Finance Global Association Board since 2015 and is a member of the Executive Committee and oversees board nominations. Judy is a co-founder of Martlet Asset Management, a new institutional investment firm. Prior to founding Martlet, Judy was a founding partner at PAMCO, the large fund of funds firm, where she was involved in all aspects of the firm's investment process, from identifying investment opportunities to working on portfolio construction and risk management. Judy has authored numerous publications in the area of alternative investments and has taught at the University of California, Riverside and Irvine, and at California State University, Fullerton. In addition to her board service for 100 Women, Judy formerly served on the global board of the Kaya Foundation, and she is the chairwoman of a nonprofit organization, The Wooden Floor. With all that said, welcome to the podcast, Judy. And really, I'm so pleased for our 100 Women in Finance members to get to know you better.
Thank you, Amanda. Judy, I really appreciate this.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm really looking forward to this session. So, Judy, it seems that you have deep roots in California. What can you tell us about your early life experiences that led you to the finance industry and to co-found your own firm twice? And would the people who knew you as a teenager be surprised by the person you are today?
Thank you. I think they would be very surprised. I'm a very quiet person, and I don't think anyone would have really expected me to, for example, get into the hedge fund industry to begin with, let alone found PAMCO and then also Martlet. I think people would have thought, if they would guess at anything, that I would have been a teacher, which is sort of the route that I was on in terms of getting into academia after graduating from school. But I was born and raised here in Southern California in Orange County. And in case people don't know Orange County, I used to always say, well, it's where Disneyland is. And growing up, the biggest things were actually Disneyland and oranges. Agriculture was basically one of the largest industries here in the county. And it's changed so much. Now, Orange County is a center for technology, biomedical research, and actually finance. From my office window here, I can look out at PIMCO's building, and they have $1.9 trillion under management, which is a number that's hard to believe, but they started here in Orange County about 50 years ago. And I have to say, it was a great place to grow up. In the 1960s, early 70s, we had excellent schools, libraries, cultural activities, all of that. And then, you know, as I said, the change that sort of basically started happening or accelerating in the 1970s into the 1980s to make it a really not so much suburban area, but a much more global area or region. But my roots aren't that deep. They are for me personally, but my parents aren't from California, and they aren't from the U.S. They are actually from Canada, and they moved to Orange County right before I was born. In fact, I was born two days after they made it here to California. So what's interesting about that is that we had no close family around. So in terms of holidays, et cetera, and older people to sort of interact with, it was all spent with family friends. And these family friends, you know, basically came from all different backgrounds, professions, religions, and so forth. So I think what it hopefully did was produce an openness and appreciation of differences, basically in ways of interacting and looking at different issues, problems, and opportunities, which I think has actually helped serve me very well. But I would say that people would be surprised at sort of where I've ended up in the professional world, particularly in hedge funds.
Well, Judy, I just learned something about you I never knew. So do you have Canadian citizenship, or were you able
no,
to?
No, I don't. That's a really interesting thing. That at the time when I was born, Canada didn't allow dual citizenship. And so my parents basically had to choose. So because they had moved here, they chose the American citizenship. But now I could go back and I could get it. Apparently, as long as you have a grandparent that was a Canadian citizen, you can also get it. So I've thought about it, but I haven't actually done it yet.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I also learned something else about you recently. You published a study nearly 30 years ago about the effect on U.S. companies' stock prices immediately following divestiture or withdrawal from South Africa during apartheid. That would actually make you a very early authority on what we'd now consider, generally speaking, to be an ESG approach to investing. Today, ESG investment options are plentiful and varied for institutional and individual investors alike. What do you make of the evolution and mainstreaming of ESG? And how did your early academic work influence the asset management firms and investment processes that you built personally?
That's an interesting question. So I started looking into ESG back in the early 90s. As you referenced, the paper that I had published was published in the 90s. And where it came from is I was sort of searching for a dissertation topic, you know, to research to do for my PhD in economics. And what was interesting at that point, if you think back that far, that the Cold War had ended. We had the fall of the Berlin Wall and so forth. And people at that point in time were talking about a peace dividend, that there would be all of this money that had been spent on, you know, military spending and so forth, that would now flow into the social activities, that there would be huge social benefits coming from, you know, the Cold War ending. I was sort of doubtful at that time because typically, at least in my opinion, it seemed to me that once a government spending program was set up, it basically would continue and that money wouldn't flow back into more social activities. But it led me to look at ESG for a dissertation topic. And the more I got into it, the more interestingly it became, it was interesting because at that point in time, it had really started to move or evolve from early work being done out of mostly religious organizations. The Episcopal Church here in the U.S., the Anglican Church in the U.K. and so forth were really big proponents of this. And now, as you can see, we've got the huge asset management firms such as BlackRock involved in heavily pushing ESG practices. But at the time that I was looking at it, it was sort of very small and very sort of preliminary in the asset management business. It was mostly shareholder resolutions, you know, different groups trying to get corporate activities to change via, you know, buying a couple of shares and then trying to get a shareholder vote on different things. What I found, though, was that it seemed to me that a focus on ESG was a good thing. It was a good thing in a number of different ways. And I think while the E, the environmental aspect, has been the most focused on, I think in the long run, the S and G, the social and governance aspects, basically have stronger implications. I think they're critical to growth and management, but they shouldn't be looked at as something separate. It's not something that's layered on top of normal business practices. It should be integrated into business practices and then also into the investment process and the investment assessment of different programs and companies and so forth. Because good governance, good environmental practices, and social policies all are a positive indication of quality and, you know, good things happening, which should be reflected in the stock price and the return to investors over the long run. So it was interesting that that was a sort of brush with the asset management industry, looking at what was being done there in terms of promoting ESG at that point in time. And I sort of got into the asset management business in an indirect way. I had planned to become an academic, and I was teaching. But a friend of mine was working at a small fund of funds here in Newport Beach and asked me to come down and help with some of the research that they were doing. So I was very lucky. I entered the hedge fund industry back in 1997. And my focus at that point in time in terms of, you know, allocations and looking at the underlying hedge funds was looking at the equity market neutral or the quantitative managers. And in hindsight, that was very, very interesting and very helpful because people have asked me, well, didn't I have issues or problems in terms of dealing with them because they were all guys for the most part. At that point in time, I don't remember any women in the space. And did they give me problems? And it was interesting in hindsight to look at it that no, they didn't. In fact, they were for the most part very, very supportive and very friendly. I think the PhD helped because it gave sort of a basis of knowledge that they knew that I knew, you know, basically what they were doing, so they could sort of start at a higher level. But after a certain point in time, what I realized in terms of interacting with them is that for the most part, they were very shy, and people would say, you know, these managers, they don't tell you what they do, you know, they're trying to keep everything secret. And I found that it was really more that it was their personalities. They were also very quiet, very shy. And once you sort of broke through that, they were more than happy to talk about what they were doing because they just felt that they had somebody that was interested. They were that was interested in talking to them and learning about what they were doing. So I think that was a good fit. And that move into the asset management space, particularly in terms of looking at hedge funds, was a really good fit for me and something that I've been really happy over the years that I've still stayed in the industry or in the space because there's always something new. There is always something new to learn or to research or to look at or somebody new, you know, that's doing something in a new way. And it's really been a very satisfying place to be. And I think it's also one of the most interesting places to have been over the last 20 years or so.
It's interesting that you talk about, you know, how you got into the business and that actually, you know, you've been asked, you know, did it feel different being a woman in that environment? Because I think the challenge for a lot of women is that they feel that they're the only one. But clearly what you found was an area where you both related to each other. So they respected your PhD. You could give something to them. And it sounds like you were very similar in terms of your characteristics. You mentioned, you know, right at the beginning that you're a quiet person, perhaps a private person. And so actually it's kind of interesting that if we can feel that we fit into a particular culture, actually that works for people. And you know, as you know, we're constantly grappling with this in, you know, from the perspective of how does 100 women encourage more young women to come into this industry to feel like they have a place. And so it's very interesting that you'd say it wasn't about gender. It was really about finding your people, if you like, and exactly. Then finding you in that environment. So I really appreciate you sharing that history. I think it's really interesting. I'd like to talk to you about scholarships. The first firm you co-founded, PAMCO, has funded full Kaya Charter scholarships for now 100 of our members over the past decade. You yourself have also endowed a scholarship at your alma mater, UC Riverside, and you're also the current chairwoman of The Wooden Floor, a youth development nonprofit organization that transforms the lives of young people in low-income communities through dance and access to higher education. So education is clearly important to you. Why have you chosen to focus on education for both your corporate and your personal philanthropy?
Well, I think that also goes back to the deep roots in California. As I had mentioned earlier, when I was growing up, we had excellent schools. If it's my understanding that at, you know, in the late 50s, early 60s and so forth, California was a leader in terms of certainly K through 12 education. And the university system here still remains very, very strong. But the public schools went from excellent to basically some of the worst in the country. And that was particularly the case during and after the global financial crisis in 2008 and onward. And what I saw there was that children at all ages needed support and a way for doors to open for them. You know, I was very lucky. I went through school. I worked part-time and so forth, but I went through school, didn't need to go into debt, didn't need to borrow anything. And it's so different today for those students. So I've always felt that being able to help someone, you know, open the door for someone to even just expand, you know, their field of vision. As you said, you know, with younger women coming up through the industry, the point of the 100 Women Kaya scholarships was to give someone that really didn't perhaps have the resources to be able to afford to take, you know, the Kaya exams on their own, to be able to do that, to see that there's a huge field here in alternatives where they actually might find their perfect spot to be in. So that's sort of the focus of the idea of education and expanding opportunities for younger people, is just to open those doors for them, to let them see what's really out there and not be as limited as they might be by financial concerns.
And I should add that the members who've received those scholarships have come from all over the world. It always has surprised me that even in locations where 100 Women doesn't have, you know, a location, that we've had applicants from many parts of the world. And that must be really, you know, fantastic for you to see, given your emphasis on giving women globally those opportunities that perhaps they wouldn't have had. So
we certainly
appreciate that.
The first couple of classes or groups of the first awardees of the scholarships, that was one of the things that was very, very surprising, is how broadly geographically diversified the applicants were. We had several from Asia, Europe, and I had really expected it to be completely different, that at least in the first few years, all of the applicants would come from the U.S. And so that was something that was, I thought, very, very good, and it just pointed to the reach of 100 Women, you know, even 10, 12 years ago, that, you know, it was picking up, it was such an important organization to young people, you know, globally.
Yeah. You were quoted in a short article in Barron's in late 2018 when you made an argument that there are more women medical doctors and veterinarians today because a generation ago, young girls saw plenty of examples of female doctors and vets. This hasn't been true in the finance industry up to now, particularly in fund management. You suggested that without relatable examples of female finance professionals, girls gravitate toward what they know and see when choosing a career. And I would completely agree with that. From the first impressions dinners that we've done, that's the observation that I've made, that the girls that come into those dinners really only see careers of people, of women that they see in particular roles. At 100 Women, we're really focused on enhancing the public visibility of female role models from the finance industry. I'd like to know more about the role models in your life and how you think 100 Women members can amplify their visibility to attract the next generation of young women in much greater numbers.
Well, I think like everyone, my parents were obviously role models. My father was a neurosurgeon. And so from him, I really saw, you know, a strong, strong work ethic. And then also, interestingly enough, sort of a commitment to lifelong learning. You know, he had strong interests sort of across different things. You know, he'd work all day at the hospital and so forth, and then take geology classes or painting classes, you know, at night just for interest. And, you know, he spoke multiple languages and so forth. So just that focus on, you know, keep learning, you know, keep your mind active, and you never know what you might find. My mother was, she didn't work after I came along. She was from a small town in rural Ontario in Canada, but became a flight attendant. And I still remember going back to visit my grandmother, and people would say, oh, it was so, you know, impressive that, and so glamorous that she had become a flight attendant coming out of such a small town. She had traveled all over and was always ready for an adventure. So that was a different aspect of things, sort of be open to new experiences, more from a sort of social point of view than sort of an academic or learning point of view. But what I saw growing up was sort of just, you know, what we were just discussing. I saw women doctors. I saw women academics. I had friends whose mothers ran businesses from the home. My best friend's mother ran a book business, which I found fascinating as a child because I loved to read, and sort of to see all of their books was always a pleasure. And then at the same time, there was sort of basically in some sense a social upheaval in the sense that a lot of women my mother's age, you know, had never probably expected to have to work. They were focused on probably doing a lot of charity work and raising their families. And then with divorce, all of a sudden they did have to work. And so a lot of women that I sort of interacted with as a child and growing up, you know, had to work. And a number of them, being in California, became real estate agents. And so I would go out and on the weekends and so forth, look at property with my dad and meet all of these really interesting women that were working in an aspect of the finance industry even then. So I thought that was quite interesting. But again, you sort of do what you see. And I saw women doctors, academics, and so forth, and I saw that as a path. The real estate agents were sort of an introduction to finance, and so it showed me that that was an interesting area that women could go into and be very, very successful. But I think the thing that's interesting, and I think one of the biggest contributions that 100 Women in Finance is making right now, is making the female fund managers visible. You know, you just have to go to the website and see all of those wonderful photos of female fund managers and now women in fintech as well. And it sort of stops the argument, well, there are no women out there. Well, yes, there are, and here's a whole bunch of them. You can see them now, actually. But I think that's not enough. I think as individuals, one of the things that we need to do is really talk to young people, both young women and young men, about what it is that we do. Because if you think about the world of finance, almost everything that we do touches society in a way that's often very, very positive. You know, think about someone managing a foundation or an endowment. Being a credit manager at one of the big credit firms or at the private equity firms, venture capital and so forth. We're really making investments in society that pay off in the long run, that benefit schools and universities, the pension plans that support teachers and police officers. You know, all of that's encompassed by the field of finance, and I don't think young people realize that. I think they get a view of the Wolf of Wall Street. I see that every week now the Wall Street Journal is following Billions and doing a sort of recap of each episode. And people think that that's what it's really like. And it is to some extent. But there's the benefits that, you know, the money that's managed, that's successfully managed, really has positive impacts on the world. And I don't think a lot of kids really realize that. So I think the more that we talk about it, the more that young women in particular will be attracted and interested in the industry because they feel that there's that social value that they don't normally think about when they think about the world of finance.
I think you put it perfectly, Judy. And, you know, as you know, we've just recently hired a global director for our pre-career initiative, Chaitali Patel, and I'm so excited about being able to encourage our members to find opportunities to really give back in this way, to be visible to the next generation. And let's see where we are in 20 years' time. And hopefully, as they begin to see the fund managers, women in fintech, women in different roles in the industry now, we'll begin to see the demographics of the industry change. So thank you for your perspectives on that. My final question is related to your role as the board's governance chair, and you lead our board nomination committee. Could you tell us what a 100 Women's Board looks for in new members and how the board determines who will be asked to serve?
Well, like all boards, we're looking for diversity. And here I think it's really important to think about diversity across a number of dynamics. You know, there's gender, geography, thought, background, and so forth. What we're really looking to do is to serve the diversity of the finance industry as a whole. And so when we're looking for people, we see varied backgrounds, anyone that can sort of promote the visibility at all stages of their careers in the finance world. So we've got traders, portfolio managers on the board, allocators from, you know, foundations and so forth, capital markets heads, CEOs of major asset management firms. And again, as I said, it's really looking for their ability to extend the reach of the organization into the industry to promote the visibility of women at all stages of their careers. What we do in terms of the nominating process is we keep a running list of people that have been nominated or suggested over the years. And we sort of start with that list each year, do a call for additional suggestions to the board. And we're reaching out, you know, again, for new people, people that, you know, may not have been someone that had been considered, you know, 5 years ago. But again, looking for that reach out into the industry. And then we start to narrow down the list. We're looking for very specific skills and focus. You know, again, perhaps someone from Europe. We have three representatives on the board now that are actually in Asia, which is really great. We still need to get a little bit more focus there in Europe. And, you know, we narrow that down, discuss the candidates at the June meeting, come up with a final list, vote on that in September, and then hopefully welcome, you know, our nominees to the board in December. But we'd really like to get, you know, suggestions for possible candidates from anyone that's out there. We've actually set up an email address if anybody would be interested in sending in a candidate suggestion, even if it's themselves. And the address is boardnominees@100women.org. And we'll be monitoring that. And, you know, you never know, a suggestion that someone might make could show up on the board in the next year or so. So we're looking for people across the industry with different skills, different backgrounds, but again, helping us to extend the reach of the organization into the industry to promote the visibility of women at all stages of their careers.
Fantastic. And just as a reminder again, then that email is boardnominees@100women.org, boardnominees@100women.org. Thank you so much, Judy, for this session. It's been fantastic to get to know you a bit better, and I'll see you at the next board meeting.
Hopefully. Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you.
Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Remember to follow 100 Women in Finance on our LinkedIn page. You can also enjoy our past programs and connect with other members in the private section of our website, Community.